Ada or Ardor, A Family Chronicle, by Vladimir Nabokov, performed by Arthur Mori.
Part 1. Chapter 1. All happy families are more or less dissimilar. All unhappy ones are more or less alike, says a great Russian writer in the beginning of a famous novel, Anna Arkadyevich Karenina, transfigured into English by R.G. Stonelower, Mount Tabor Limited, 1880. That pronouncement has little, if any, relation to the story to be unfolded now, A Family Chronicle, the first part of which is, perhaps, closer to another Tolstoy work, Detstvo i Otrochestvo, Childhood and Fatherland, Pontius Press, 1858. Van's maternal grandmother, Daria Dolly Dermanov, was the daughter of Prince Peter Zemsky, governor of Bras d'Or, an American province in the northeast of our great and variegated country, who had married in 1824 Mary O'Reilly, an Irish woman of fashion. Dolly, an only child, was born in Bras, married in 1840, at the tender and wayward age of 15, General Ivan Dermanov, commander of Yukon Fortress and peaceful country gentleman, with lands in the Severn Tories, Severnia Territorii, that tessellated protectorate still lovingly called Russian Estoty, which commingles granoblastically and organically with Russian Kanady, otherwise French Estoty, where not only French but Macedonian and Bavarian settlers enjoy a halcyon climate under our stars and stripes. The Dermanovs' favorite domain, however, was Raduga, near the burg of that name, beyond the Stoty land proper, in the Atlantic panel of the continent between elegant Kaluga, New Cheshire, USA, and no less elegant Ladoga, Maine, where they had their townhouse and where their three children were born. A son who died young and famous, and a pair of difficult female twins. Dolly had inherited her mother's beauty and temper, but also an older ancestral strain of whimsical and not seldom deplorable taste, well reflected, for instance, in the names she gave her daughters, Aqua and Marina. "Why not Tofana?" wondered the good and Sir Royally antlered general with a controlled belly laugh, followed by a small closing cough of feigned detachment. He dreaded his wife's flares. On April 23rd, 1869, in drizzly and warm, gauzy and green Kaluga, Aqua, aged 25 and afflicted with her usual vernal migraine, married Walter D. Veen, a Manhattan banker of ancient Anglo-Irish ancestry, who had long conducted and was soon to resume intermittently a passionate affair with Marina. The latter, sometime in 1871, married her first lover's first cousin, also Walter D. Veen, a quite as opulent but much duller chap. The D in the name of Aqua's husband stood for Demon, a form of Damien or Dementius, and thus was he called by his kin. In society, he was generally known as Raven Veen, or simply Dark Walter, to distinguish him from Marina's husband, Durak Walter, or simply Red Veen. Demon's twofold hobby was collecting old masters and young mistresses. He also liked middle-aged puns. Daniel Veen's mother was a Trumbull, and he was prone to explain at great length, unless sidetracked by a boar baiter, how in the course of American history an English bull had become a New England belle. Somehow or other he had gone into business in his 20s and had rather rankly grown into a Manhattan art dealer. He did not have, initially at least, any particular liking for paintings, had no aptitude for any kind of salesmanship, and no need whatever to jolt with the ups and downs of a job, a solid fortune inherited from a series of far more proficient and venturesome Veens. Confessing that he did not much care for the countryside, he spent only a few carefully shaded summer weekends at Ardis, his magnificent manor near Lador. He had revisited only a few times since his boyhood another estate he had up north on Lake Katej near Luga, comprising and practically consisting of that large, oddly rectangular, though quite natural body of water, which a perch he had once clocked took half an hour to cross diagonally, and which he owned jointly with his cousin, a great fisherman in his youth. Poor Dan's erotic life was neither complicated nor beautiful, but somehow or other, he soon forgot the exact circumstances as one forgets the measurements and price of a fondly made topcoat worn on and off for at least a couple of seasons, he fell comfortably in love with Marina, whose family he had known when they still had their Raduga place, later sold to Mr. Elliot, a Jewish businessman. One afternoon in the spring of 1871, he proposed to Marina in the up elevator of Manhattan's first 10-floor building, was indignantly rejected at the 7th stop, Toys, came down alone, and, to air his feelings, set off in a counter-fog direction on a triple trip round the globe, adopting, like an animated parallel, the same itinerary every time. In November 1871, as he was in the act of making his evening plans with the same smelly but nice cicerone in a café au lait suit, whom he had hired already twice at the same Genoese hotel, an aero cable from Marina, forwarded with a whole week's delay via his Manhattan office, which had filed it away through a new girl's oversight in a dove hole marked R.E. Amour, arrived on a silver salver telling him she would marry him upon his return to America. According to the Sunday supplement of a newspaper that had just begun to feature on its funnies page, the now long defunct Goodnight Kids, Nikki and Pimpernella, sweet siblings who shared a narrow bed, and that survived with other old papers in the cock loft of Artists' Hall, the Veen-Dermanoff wedding took place on St. Adelaide's Day, 1871. 12 years and some 8 months later, two naked children, one dark-haired and tanned, the other dark-haired and milk-white, bending in a shaft of hot sunlight slanted through the dormer window under which the dusty carton stood, happened to collate that date, December 16th, 1871, with another, August 16th, same year, anachronistically scrawled in Marina's hand across the corner of a professional photograph, in a raspberry plush frame on her husband's knee-hole library table, identical in every detail, including the commonplace sweep of a bride's ectoplasmic veil, partly blown by a parvis breeze athwart the groom's trousers, to the newspaper reproduction. A girl was born on July 21st, 1872, at Artists, her putative father's seat in Lodore County, and for some obscure mnemonic reason was registered as Adelaida. Another daughter, this time Dan's very own, followed on January 3rd, 1876. Besides that old illustrated section of the still existing but rather gaga Kaluga Gazette, our frolicsome Pimpernel and Nicolette found in the same attic a real box containing what turned out to be, according to Kim, the kitchen boy, as will be understood later, a tremendous stretch of microfilm taken by the Globetrotter, with many of its quaint bazaars, painted cherubs, and pissing urchins reappearing 3 times at different points in different shades of heliocolor. Naturally, at a time one was starting to build a family, one could not display very well certain intérieurs, such as the group scenes in Damascus starring him and the steadily cigar-smoking archaeologist from Arkansas with the fascinating scar on his liver side, and the 3 fat whores, and old Archie's premature squitteroo as the 3rd male member of the party. A real British brick, drolly called it. Yet most of the film, accompanied by purely factual notes, not always easy to locate because of the elusive or misleading bookmarks in the several guidebooks scattered around, was run by Dan many times for his bride during their instructive honeymoon in Manhattan. The 2 kids' best find, however, came from another carton in a lower layer of the past. This was a small green album with neatly glued flowers that Marina had picked or otherwise obtained at X, a mountain resort not far from Brieg, Switzerland, where she had sojourned before her marriage, mostly in a rented chalet. The first 20 pages were adorned with a number of little plants collected at random in August 1869 on the grassy slopes above the chalet, or in the park of the Hotel Flory, or in the garden of the sanatorium near it. My Nusshaus, as poor Aqua dubbed it, or the home, as Marina more demurely identified it in her locality notes. Those introductory pages did not present much botanical or psychological interest, and the 50 last pages or so remained blank. But the middle part, with a conspicuous decrease in number of specimens, proved to be a regular little melodrama acted out by the ghosts of dead flowers. The specimens were on one side of the folio, with Marina Durmanoff's notes en regard. Ancoli Bleu des Alpes, Aix-en-Valais, 1 November 69, from Englishman in hotel. Alpine columbine, color of your eyes. Epervier auricule, 25 October 69. X, ex-Dr. Lapinaire's walled alpine garden. Golden ginkgo leaf, fallen out of a book. The Truth About Terra, which Aqua gave me before going back to her home, 14 December 69. Artificial Edelweiss, brought by my new nurse with a note from Aqua saying it came from a misernoia and bizarre Christmas tree at the home, 25 December 69. Petal of Orchid, one of 99 orchids, if you please, mailed to me yesterday, special delivery. C'est bien le cas de la dire, from Villa Armina, Alpes Maritime. Have laid aside 10 for Aqua to be taken to her at her home, Aix-en-Valais, Switzerland. Snowing in fate's crystal ball, as he used to say. Date erased. Gentienne de Coche, rare, brought by Lapochka, darling Lapinaire, from his mute genitarium. 5 January, 1870. Blue ink blot shaped accidentally like a flower or improved felt pen deletion. Complicaria complicata, variety of Aquamarina X. 15 January, 70. Fancy flower of paper found in Aqua's purse X. 16 February, 1870. Made by a fellow patient at the home, which is no longer hers. Gentiana Verna, Printanière, X, 28 March, 1870, on the lawn of my nurse's cottage. Last day here. The two young discoverers of that strange and sickening treasure commented upon it as follows. I deduce, said the boy, three main facts. That not yet married Marina and her married sister hibernated in my lieu de naissance. That Marina had her own Dr. Krolik, pour ainsi dire. And that the orchids came from Dumont, who preferred to stay by the sea, his dark blue great-grandmother. I can add, said the girl, that the petal belongs to the common butterfly orchis, that my mother was even crazier than her sister, and that the paper flower so cavalierly dismissed is a perfectly recognizable reproduction of an early spring senecal that I saw in profusion on hills in coastal California last February. Dr. Krolik, our local naturalist, to whom you, Van, have referred as Jane Austen, might have phrased it, for the sake of rapid narrative information. You recall Brown, don't you, Smith? Has determined the example I brought back from Sacramento to Ardis as the barefoot, B-E-A-R, my love, not my foot or yours, or the Stabian flower girls, an allusion which your father, who, according to Blanche, is also mine, would understand like this. American finger snap. You will be grateful, she continued, embracing him, for my not mentioning its scientific name. Incidentally, the other foot, the pied de lion from that poor little Christmas larch, is, by the same hand, possibly belonging to a very sick Chinese boy who came all the way from Berklee College. Good for you, Pompeianella, whom you saw scattering her flowers in one of Uncle Dan's picture books, but whom I admired last summer in a Naples museum. Now, don't you think we should resume our shorts and shirts and go down and bury or burn this album at once, girl? Right? Right, answered Ada. Destroy and forget. But we still have an hour before tea. R.E., the dark blue illusion, left hanging. A former viceroy of Astati, Prince Ivan Temusini, father of the children's great-great-grandmother, Princess Sofia Zemsky, 1755-1809, and a direct descendant of the Yaroslav rulers of pre-Tatar times, had a millennium-old name that meant, in Russian, dark blue. While happening to be immune to the sumptuous thrills of genealogic awareness and indifferent to the fact that oafs attribute both the aloofness and the fervor to snobbishness, Van could not help feeling aesthetically moved by the velvet background he was always able to distinguish as a comforting, omnipresent summer sky through the black foliage of the family tree. In later years, he had never been able to reread Proust, as he had never been able to enjoy again the perfumed gum of Turkish paste without a roll wave of surfeit and a rasp of gravelly heartburn. Yet his favorite purple passage remained the one concerning the name Guermantes, with whose hue his adjacent ultramarine merged in the prism of his mind, pleasantly teasing Van's artistic vanity.
Hue or who? Awkward. Reword.
Marginal note in Ada Wien's late